Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this podcast topic is airspace as a weapon, focusing on the upcoming publication of FM3-52, Airspace. Usually we wait until after a book is published, but because airspace is such a relevant topic on today's battlefield, we decided to give you a peek at how FM3-52 is changing. We welcome back to the show Colonel John Sander, Director of the Army Joint Support Team at Herbert Field, Florida. We also welcome back CW4 Austin Kilpatrick. He works at First Corps as the Senior Air Traffic and Airspace Management Technician. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So FM352 is currently in final draft staffing, and we don't expect too many changes before publication. Let's look at the first visible change. Before you even get past the first page, you will notice that the name changed from Airspace Control in the 2016 version to just Airspace. What was your thought process on the name change?
FM352, over the course of its life, has changed multiple times. And quite frankly, at this point, there's a lot of misconceptions that it was only for airspace control. It didn't touch all of the other facets of what happens within airspace. So some of the airspace management functions, some of those other requirements that are being executed. And so rather than limit the target audience, we wanted to make sure we opened it up so all airspace users knew that that was the doctrinal reference to go to. And so not only does it talk about airspace control, it also talks about airspace management. It talks about functions that happen within the air domain. And so it's much broader than just specifically focused on airspace control. And we didn't want to pigeonhole the title to only a portion of the requirement and more into the holistic look of airspace.
And also, you know, I will add that we talked about this in the previous podcast. We were discussing all warfighting functions or all Army elements are airspace users at one point or another in order to accomplish their mission. And so we also draw attention to a whole of staff effort to complete a unit airspace plan. Each staff entity, logistics as a prime example, they have working groups of their own, which sometimes airspace personnel don't always attend because, you know, we're kind of spread thin. There's only a few of us in the division headquarters or the Corps. But those logistics personnel may require a fixed-wing aircraft or an Army rotary-wing aircraft to utilize the air domain to deliver a capability. And so they have to find the right person, the airspace person in their headquarters, and make sure that their requirements are coordinated either through the Joint Force or for the Army in their unit airspace plan.
Thanks. I'm also curious, you know, as the Army as an institution is focused on large-scale combat operations, what should our institutional memory about COIN be? Or let me ask it another way. So what are some good or bad lessons learned that we can take from our COIN experiences and apply to today's environment?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of lessons that we learned and some specific to capabilities. And so in Global War on Terrorism, we benefited from years of the Air Force executing missions over top of Iraq and having clearly air superiority capabilities. And so we weren't worried about another Air Force that was going to have to engage our aircraft. Our rotary wing pilots weren't worried about other fixed wing aircraft or rotary wing aircraft that were coming to attack them. And so we were able to do a lot more in the air domain because A, we controlled all the facets of it, but B, we set conditions to be able to enable everybody. And so some of the bad lessons learned was we no longer requested aircraft. The Air Force just put caps of aircraft up to support ground maneuver units. And when you needed air support, you got on the radio and you called for it, and you received an aircraft, generally speaking. And so in large-scale combat operations, that same model does not work when you're talking air parity or local air superiority. You have to worry about what's going on around you. You want pilots that are focused on actions that are happening on the ground. Well, they have to be able to know that their wingmen or buddies are protecting them from above so that they can focus on your mission set. So there's some very stark differences from global war on terrorism in terms of what we did in the air domain. We were pretty nonchalant in terms of following our airspace control measures. Essentially, we would go straight point to point for places, understanding that because nothing was really flying in the air other than our rotary wing or fixed wing, that we had some flexibility to do that. Now, there's a structure that's built and put in place to facilitate the integration of all airspace users. And in large-scale combat operations, we don't have the ability to just deconflict on the go. We have to integrate everything if we want to bear all of our assets on the enemy.
And I would also say that the number and type of targets and enemy formations that we're going to see in large-scale combat operations are going to far outweigh what we've seen in counterinsurgency with, you know, limited pockets of resistance and non-contiguous AOs, right? So we are going to see thousands of enemy targets, and we're going, and the commander is going to have to prioritize what they want to look at and when. So as an example, in counterinsurgency operations, we got very comfortable with taking an ISR asset and just moving it around whenever we thought we might identify a target. In large-scale combat operations, that's going to be less effective because you're not thinking of the second and third order effects that you're going to have by now moving that ISR platform into an airspace that wasn't previously designated. There may be an interdiction mission that the operator wasn't aware about that's coming in to do something. Or you may be shooting surface fires and the commander's not willing to accept risk to lose that particular ISR platform to shoot through that airspace. And so, you know, chasing the shiny object, as I like to call it sometimes, that we could do in counterinsurgency operations pretty effectively is not going to be as effective in large-scale combat operations. And so those volumes of airspace that we are building to protect our own assets and to also apply effects are important as we start to use the finite resource that is the air domain.
You both are kind of giving me flashbacks to my time overseas. And, sir, I think you graciously said flexibility. My thought is we weren't very disciplined.
Yeah, I would agree with you, ma'am. And actually, recently, I talked about manned aircraft Army aviators and manned aircraft being more disciplined in their approach of requesting airspace that they need. And that is important as we start to proliferate the air domain with thousands of unmanned systems. It is important that we know where our manned aircraft are going to be. We're going to have a lot less manned aircraft utilizing airspace and a lot more fires and unmanned systems utilizing airspace.
Yeah, and as you talk about discipline, I mean, yes, discipline is a large part of it, but we also didn't do all the planning we normally would do. And so we kind of used the air domain as an open canvas in a lot of ways in GWAT. And so we weren't as precise in how we were building unit airspace plans and where we were setting corridors for aircraft to travel. And there's plenty of videos on the internet where you can see aircraft dropping bombs and Chinooks flying underneath or Blackhawks coming up on a firing point in Afghanistan coming across the gun line. So, I mean, there's plenty of places where that discipline almost cost us in a large capacity. But in some ways, it was we didn't plan to do that either. And so we didn't set the conditions right to be able to do that. And so it's some of both. It was flexibility in that we didn't have any opposing air threats really that drove us to do it. And it was the discipline of when we did build them, did we build them appropriately or account for them in how we executed? And I think there's a finite difference. And as you talk to a lot of commanders out there, they'll say, particularly on the aviation side, hey, give me the bubble around where the battery is. Give me a bubble around where the target is. I'll stay below 500 feet, and you won't have to worry about where I'm flying. Well, there's some truth to that, but there's a lot of things that are not true to that. There are so many other airspace users that it's just not as flexible. And I recognize that we're using aviation as a maneuver force, but air ground maneuver still has avenues and control measures in which we maneuver our forces through and by phase lines where they're going to make radio contact for how we control the pace of movement. We have to apply that same discipline in the air domain to our maneuver force to facilitate that same structure across how we execute.
So talking about the last episode, we really focused on the air domain and how leaders should be thinking about the air domain. I'd like to talk more about how the Armory operates, plans, and coordinates within the air domain. I think that applies a little bit more to 352. So could you first talk big picture and tell listeners what the theater air ground system, or TAGS, is and how we operate under that?
I'll take that one, ma'am. So the theater air ground system is a doctrinal framework for the joint force to form the airspace control system. So normally the airspace control authority will promulgate the airspace control plan, and the theater air ground system is that baseline foundation for them. So it talks about what each component does to form the theater air ground system and how they command and control air assets and also request support from other joint users. And the Army's portion of that is the Army Air Ground System. And we are a little bit more unique than, say, the Marine Corps or the Navy, but we rely on a sister service, the Air Force, to round out our command and control capability. And they do that in the form of tactical air control parties from battalion all the way up through Corps. And they also have the Air Support Operations Center, which normally resides at the division level. And so those command and control capabilities from those assets or those personnel and material solutions that they have allow us to do command and control with the Army Air Ground System.
So when you're talking, when we say system, so theater air ground system or Army air ground system, it's not just a piece of hardware. It's a whole people.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it is. It forms a total weapon system of doctrine, of course, as the baseline, personnel, and then systems to operate, or personnel to operate those systems, and of course, the process.
In its simplest terms, it's our liaison capability. And so, and I'm not talking single person type liaisons. Mm-hmm. You're talking multiple people that form the elements that come. So when we talk about the JTACs, that's part of the Air Force's contribution to the Army in terms of how they would employ aircraft through the Army talking to those JTACs. And so you have the JTACs that fall under Tactical Air Control Party. And so you've got that linkage that goes all the way back to the Air Force side into the AOC, the Air Operations Center, of how they control all their aircraft. And so when you get a CAS aircraft, a CAS mission, and an aircraft that is supporting it, how it is passed from the AOC, from its launch point, all the way to the point of how the Army is going to use it on the ground. And so there's that structure of liaisons that help to facilitate those requirements at each echelon to ensure that we're doing the things that each of the services need to be able to function appropriately. And so the Army's got liaisons, whether it be the Battlefield Coordination Detachment inside of the Air Operations Center or some of the other liaison requirements that we provide back to the Air Force, so they understand prior to mission what our requirements are, what those battlefield updates are, where formations are on the battlefield. So before that air crew jumps in the aircraft to take off to support your mission, they've got a briefing from an Army guy that gives them that basic information.
So it's how green integrates with blue and how blue integrates with green at every level. Okay.
Yeah, and from a more holistic standpoint, I mean, we're looking specifically TACS-AGS, but it's much bigger than that. So the Marine Corps has liaisons that do the same thing. The Navy has liaisons that do the same thing. The Army has liaisons that go to, as we continue to work in the Indo-Pacific, working specifically with the Navy, so that we have those same integration capabilities across all the services.
Yeah, in fact, in U.S. Army Pacific, feedback from them is they are using personnel from their theater fires element out of their staff to go over and fill in at Pacific Fleet Maritime Operations Center to round out that capability we discussed, because they recognize some of a shortfall in our liaison connective tissue, if you will, to the maritime component. So we're trying to fulfill that gap through using some of our personnel from the Army staff up at the Theater Army.
Gotcha. So last episode, we talked about the JAJIC and the acronyms are the ASOC.
Air Support Operations Center, yes, ma'am.
Being involved with the JAJIC. So is that part, so kind of two parts question, is that part of the tags then that we talked about, theater, air, ground?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And then the second part is I'd like to talk more about kind of the history of the JAJIC, or the JAJIC TTP, how that was formed. And I don't even know what we had before the JAJIC. That was before my time, I feel like.
So pre-2002, most of the airspace clearance was by what we could see. And it was less about all of the other procedures that we've put in place. The Army has always operated in a procedural control. We build the procedural control measures, and we expect the discipline to use those measures. And so our ability to integrate surface fires, our ability to integrate aircraft, were all accounted for in those procedures. And quite frankly, prior to 2002, you had a handful of, particularly at the brigade and division level, you had a handful of rotary wing capabilities and you had a handful of fixed wing capabilities that you would get. We did not have anywhere near the number of, well, quite frankly, before 2002, we really had no UAS capabilities at those echelons. And so the airspace was much simpler in terms of how we would facilitate operations using the air domain. Post, and I would offer that really about 2008, 2009, as UAS really started to proliferate airspace, artillery started to gain longer ranges. Our rotary wing, we looked at how we would get them deeper into the fight. We started to realize that we had a stretch capability that we didn't really understand how we could do all the functions that we wanted to, and we needed a capability to get there. And 2008 is when the Army and the Air Force really started to have the first conversations, and that was pre-named, but that was really the genesis of the JAJIC. So the Army and the Air Force spent about 3 years doing experimentation starting around 2008. About 2011 is when they started to bring online what we would now call the JAJIC, but it was kind of a shell of a JAJIC. Really about 2015, 2016, with the rewrite of the JAJIC TTP, really the second rewrite at that point, really brought the JAJIC into what we see today. And so that functional capability of the teaming requirements, the systems, how they facilitate operations, having the right people from air defense community, from the aviation community, from the fires community, from the Air Force, all brought together to facilitate the common understanding of what was going on in the air domain and being able to articulate that to all joint airspace users is really where the JAJIC, in a lot of ways, changed. Pre-2015, we were still kind of storming and norming to figure out how that fit together. Around 2016, 2017 is when we really started to move the ball, if you will, in terms of what the JAJIC was, how it functioned, the specific authorities that came with the JAJIC from the Airspace Control Authority. And the Army realized that in order for us to do this, we had to develop some sort of academic capability to teach what does doctrine say about airspace. Because previous to that, there were some discussions in some PME, but it wasn't holistically focused on what airspace was. And that was really the genesis of the Echelons Above Brigade airspace course that is really the feeder for the JAJIC. So folks actually understand, what does joint doctrine say? What does Army doctrine say? What does Air Force doctrine say in terms of application of air power? How do we facilitate the Army's use of airspace? What are the right measures and capabilities to be able to do that? And that's where Army Joint Support Team in 2016-17 really picked up the Echelons Above Brigade airspace course, developed the specialized joint airspace training and really started to move JAJIC to what we see today.
And my understanding is JAJIC is only at the division level. Is there any appetite for it to be at the core level?
So we do hear a lot of commanders saying that they want a JAGIC or a Joint Air Ground Integration Center within their core headquarters. This is kind of in large part potentially due to a misunderstanding of what the JAGIC capability really is providing and what it was designed to do. We talked about history. Prior to us having the Air Support Operations Center located at Division, it used to be a standalone function that was often associated with Corps headquarters. Not really true. What that Corps would do is request clearance, airspace clearance from the ASOC. But as Colonel Sandor alluded to, we increased the capacity and volume of airspace users in the Division AO. And in order for us to facilitate that, we have to be able to do it really at the division level because they have the best situational understanding and awareness, and they also have that connective tissue to that brigade, which the JAGIC really is purpose-built to support brigades, Army brigades, because that's where the largest volume of fires and that's where the largest volume of airspace users. That's also where we integrate our joint users to conduct close air support. And so that's really what it's about. Also, what leaders fail to understand is the way that the Air Force does airspace command and control. If you move an ASOC out of one division, you, in essence, lose that capability at all divisions. Because if you pull that ASOC up to core, the Air Force does not stack ASOCs. And this is due to, you know, the uniqueness of how they do command and control. And so other ASOCs can't be clearing their own airspace with an ASOC above them at the core. And so now you have limited your divisions and brigades' ability to clear fires and to conduct joint or to administer joint effects in their area of operation because they now have to all go through core. And so if you could imagine 14 to 16 brigades requesting close air support from core or requesting clearance of fire from core, and also having to talk up to the core ASOC to launch unmanned systems, for instance, I think you would find that it's extremely ineffective. And so in this case, instead of having the one, I'll use the Lord of the Rings reference here, the one JAGIC to control them all, it's really better to have three. Three is better than one, you know. So bringing that ASOC capability up to core, you're now losing capability at each of your divisions.
And I would offer, there's the fact that at the division, there is a lot more dynamic execution. Things are changing faster on the battlefield for, particularly in the air domain, of how the division is going to execute the fight. The Corps is much more focused on deliberate. They're planning much further out. They're planning where those fires are going to go in. And so really the Corps is controlling the measures in which they need to execute, and so executing their unit airspace plan, whereas there are things that are so dynamic within the division's volume of airspace that are changing that they need the ability to make some of those changes based off of unit movement times. When can I facilitate getting those aircraft? They may get delayed because of maintenance, but now I can't bring them in on their original route structure because we've got the prep mission going in for another operation, and I need to be able to reroute those aircraft. Still need to be able to support that unit, but I need to reroute them in a different way to get to that target. There's a lot more to the requirements at the division level than there are at the core level in that execution. And so in 2019, through CAC, there was an effort, the JTEC, really to focus on the core level requirements. And initially, from an Air Force perspective, it was the enhanced TACP program is what the Air Force was using to fill those requirements. But essentially, it was a mixture of Army and TACP Air Force personnel, not with a controlling capability, but with the capability to communicate back to the air users from the Air Force that would be executing, supporting the core missions. And so those interdiction aircraft that were approved through the joint targeting cycle were came out on the joint through the joint air tasking cycle as part of a resource requirement and then had deliberate target that they were going to strike. That was really facilitated through the JTEC at CORE to enable them really to do the functions that they needed to, because quite frankly, we don't need the CORE to talk to every single aircraft that's going to be flying through their area to execute a mission deep. And I don't think the Corps commander really wants that focus. The Corps commander wants to be able to functionally talk to and execute the things that impact the Corps fight. And so things that are executing strategic or for outside the Corps boundaries, but would still have to fly through their airspace, much like we talked before, would still have to check in and check out with the Corps. And now you add the doctrinal distances of where the Corps headquarters would be in relation to the Corps' forward boundary, our ability to communicate with those aircraft is probably very limited. And as we spread those distances, both in width and depth, that is another problem set that the Corps commander would have to deal with if we started to talk about controlling a volume of airspace forward of the division out to the Corps boundary that generates a different problem set for transition between controlling elements, between who's talking to the Air Operations Center in terms of clearance or to taxi to for clearance for things that are going out. Because currently, the Corps are pushing those MLRS units right up into the division's footprint, right on the backside of the maneuver formations. And that JAGIC in the division is doing all of the airspace requirements to get that munition to where it needs to go. So they're talking to whether it be AWACS, CRC, AOC, or to what we would call taxi to the other airspace elements to support those requirements. And now you're adding another layer on, because now you've got to talk not only from where that munition would be launched to where it breaks the coordinating altitude at the JAGIC level, then the next airspace element from above that coordinating altitude till it comes back into the next coordinating altitude, and then another airspace element all the way to its impact point. And so we can kind of clean some of that up and help to really facilitate both integration of joint assets and the clearance of fires much more rapidly without having add-on or bolt-on multiple airspace controlling elements, particularly in smaller spaces.
When you, that element at the Corps level, is it JTAP or JTEC?
JTEC.
What does that stand for?
Joint Target Engagement Capability. To Colonel Sandor's point, what I will say is, in simplest terms, the Corps commander is not really gaining anything by moving the JAGIC to their level. In fact, they're probably losing because they're taking away from their divisions. And so understanding what you're actually requesting, you know, where Corps fight supporting and setting conditions for those divisions is so far out that they have time to plan. Those targets are often, if they are mobile, they're being struck by an Air Force asset, an interdiction mission. But if they are stationary or fixed in time and place, those surface-to-surface fires can get to that target without the kind of coordination and dynamic changes that we would see at the division level. So really losing capability, as we said, by trying to move that ASOC up to core.
Okay. I want to shift a little bit to one of the appendices in 352. You have an entire unit airspace plan appendix. So could you tell listeners about the unit airspace plan, or UAP, what that is, and why there's more emphasis in this version of 352 than the previous?
And Austin can talk much more detailed in terms of how functionally it works, but I'll kind of give you the overview here. Much like we talked at the beginning of the program about in GWAT, we were undisciplined and we really didn't do a lot of the planning associated with our requirements. The unit airspace plan has been around for years, but it's never been codified in any document. It's kind of urban legend, if you will, of here's the requirement, but there's no functional doctrine or TTP out there that describes what it is and what the procedures are to build it. And what we've realized is with the complexity that has changed, we really need to educate the force on what are those requirements? How do we build airspace that is feasible for all of the joint force? How do we integrate all of the things we want to bring to bear on the enemy so that we're not shutting things off? If you go back in history, we used to use know, grid line separation or altitude separation or time separation. And so we never really brought all those assets to bear at the same time on a target. We would figure out, hey, you stay east of this grid line and I'll shoot west of that grid line. And so if you could range it or in some cases launch your effect that it would impact on that side, great. But otherwise, keep your aircraft over there and we'll make sure we can facilitate it. In some ways, in today's modern battlefield, we don't have those same luxuries. Although those same principles still exist, it's not really integrating all of our assets. It's more deconflicting them so that we can do things in different places. And so really the emphasis in the unit airspace plan, one is to get it in doctrine so it's defined, and two is to be able to articulate the critical understanding to the end user of why it's so important. How do we apply all those procedural control measures into a plan that facilitates integrating the joint assets? Or quite frankly, even if you look at it from a brigade level, how do I integrate all my brigade assets? I've got all these UAS now. I've got to account for them somehow. I've got mortars. I've got DS artillery. We still have to account for how we're going to bring those all into the fight. And so this is the attempt to get back to what really has been the hallmark previously of procedural control, but put it into a doctrinal format that now codifies what those requirements really are.
Yeah, and I would add to that, the unit airspace plan before was viewed as just the 150 Alpha's job. Now, your 150 Alpha does make sure he has his requirements integrated and sends them up on systems to make sure they're coordinated, which is tactical airspace integration system is how we do that. But it is a whole of staff effort. And that is one thing that as we teach the courses down in Hurlburt, we've been really kind of understanding. And so a very smart Major Young came through our course and he assisted us. He's from the Mission Command Training Program. He assisted us in trying to write a sort of matrix of what warfighting functions were responsible to provide what and help us. And so that's really what the UAP appendix does, is it shows leaders of those warfighting functions things that they may want to consider when they're trying to contribute to or request airspace. And so we break it out like that by warfighting function and the things that you need to see, because it is the compilation of maneuver control measures, fire support coordination measures, airspace coordinating measures, and air defense measures all coupled into one planning package that goes up digitally to the air component for inclusion on the airspace control order.
Kilpatrick's exactly right on this. But what I would say is, because as you build it from the brigade, you build it to the division, and you submit as you move it from echelon to echelon, the piece that we as an Army fail to really understand is we think that we're waiting for the Air Force to approve a lot of those measures. In a lot of ways, particularly if the JADC has been delegated a volume of airspace, we're approving those measures ourselves, and we're informing the rest of the joint force of what those measures are by getting it included into the airspace control order. We're not asking the Air Force to approve those measures for inclusion. We're telling them that that's what we approved and what needs to be included. And so there's some slight differences if we're talking about from an airspace management perspective, and we're talking things that are not inside the volume of airspace that we have an element that controls versus things that are separate. So if it's inside that element that we control, then we, the Army, are approving our measures and setting those conditions. We may have things or requirements from the joint force that we have to execute within there, but we are building those measures in and articulating where they are. Some of the joint measures we may have to negotiate with the Air Force where we need it based off our operations and how they have to do fueling and refuel operations to get those aircraft to where they need to. But those are, if you will, the exception to the rule. Inside that volume of airspace, we're approving the rest of those measures to facilitate our operations.
Okay. Both the last episode that we met concerning the air domain and this episode, we've talked a lot about joint operations and joint integration of airspace. I'd like to talk about allies and partners. How do we integrate with their planning efforts when it comes to airspace?
The effort is ongoing currently. 19th BCD and our NATO partners have kind of taken on the effort of how do we expand a JAGIC-like capability to our NATO partners. Most of our NATO partners, at least currently, have very distinct doctrine that separates things that ground forces do and things that the air forces do. And so they do not have the same integration or requirements that we do. And so they see the world differently in terms of the application of things in that volume of airspace. A lot of those countries are more tied to big sky, little bullet theory and less about procedural control measures and how we facilitate it. Some of those countries either have or have very little or no rotary wing or fixed wing capabilities. And so they have no airspace requirements in terms of how do I clear airspace with another service. So currently what's underway is at the NATO cores, because they're more stable in terms of people being at them and capabilities, a JAGIC-like education for how it's joint air-land integration is the handbook that they've recently produced. But it's really how we're going to start to integrate land and air requirements together. And I would offer it will probably be much like we experience. It's going to take a couple of years of experimentation and changes in doctrine and philosophy in terms of how we apply it and how we bring those measures to bear for the coalition partners. We have seen in some of our recent warfighters, some countries, the UK and a couple others, have gone on their own and built a JAGIC-like capability. It's not exactly the same as ours. In some ways, based off how they do business, it better fits their model. And so there are some countries out there that have kind of experimented to see how they could employ it most effectively. But some countries are still trying to figure it out. And here recently, as more countries are starting to get rocket-type systems, whether it be from U.S. or from other countries in terms of MLRS, multiple launch rocket systems, or the high-mobility rocket systems in HIMARS, or like capabilities, they're realizing that there is a greater need to understand where in the air domain those assets reside. And so there's a fundamental change that will happen across NATO as we start to talk air-land integration and how we bring that to bear. We did a class with Romania, and one of the Romanian aviation officers said, "That's not how we do business. Air takes care of air, ground takes care of ground, and we don't talk to each other. We will never give a volume of airspace to the ground to deal with." And so that cultural shift will have to take place before you can really start to integrate it. And where I think it becomes, at least in the near term, a problem is as you look at the reduction in scale of the Air Force in terms of number of aircraft currently, and you look at the European problem set, as you build the air requirements, it will be a coalition effort with airframes from all of those countries. And so how do we articulate how we do business in a what would be a division AO versus a coalition AO that's adjacent to it? In some of the warfighters, we've seen U.S. divisions take on that same volume of airspace to support a coalition unit. We've seen other units try to do it. I think there's a kind of a happy medium in there in terms of how you establish the coordinating altitude based off of their airspace requirements. Because, quite frankly, they don't need to talk to every aircraft that's going through. And so how do we facilitate those requirements to best enable them to execute the functions that they need to execute?
Yeah, and I would like to pivot over to the Pacific here and take a look at some very unique challenges the Pacific has. You know, we don't have a NATO governing body in the Pacific, similar to how we do in Europe, right? So, you know, you've got a NATO air-land integration publication, and the Pacific doesn't have that. They have bilateral agreements that are often limited in scope and scale based on whatever they're going to execute. And those are one country at a time, you know, between U.S. and that country. And so they are working to do similar things like with Australia and other countries. Japan, I'm sure, is also probably going to come along and form something similar to a JAGIC-like capability. But we're a little bit further behind because we don't have that unifying body like NATO for us to all come together and agree to follow that doctrine. And so as we continue to operate in and out of the Indo-Pacific, I think those challenges similar to what we're finding in Europe are going to also come up as well.
Thanks. And thanks for joining us today. Any other thoughts for our listeners?
So the thing I would add is from FM352, we've talked about it a couple times. It's not just airspace professionals that need to know and understand it. We need to get this across to most of the Army, because everybody at this point has something that they're either utilizing a volume of airspace or putting an object into airspace at this point. And we need to understand how we do that. And the processes, procedures that we employ, the specific measures, how they're named, how they fit into that unit airspace plan, understanding what airspace management and airspace control are and the differences between them are critical to us being able to successfully integrate all of our air using systems in the future fight. As we look at 2030, the Army of 2030, and things with like M-SHORAD coming back, how do we integrate that volume of airspace within the division's footprint for air defense? How do we include the counter UAS fight into the airspace? And so as we move forward, this is a holistic document. It's just not an airspace professional specific document. It needs to be understood across the Army.
And I would also add, as we start to move toward 2030, our planning efforts are going to grow more important than ever with the introduction of AI and machine learning. And so the machine is only as good as the plan that you feed it. And so if you feed it nothing, it thinks all the airspace is clear. And so as we start to move toward, toward pushing artificial intelligence and machine learning down to these tactical echelons, and of course the division and the Corps, to clear fires, to integrate airspace requirements, we need to make sure that our leaders and operators are well educated to understand if the machine's actually telling them something that's important or not, and also that they can quickly and effectively ensure that what the machine is telling them is good and accept risk on that. And so, the training and education are extremely important.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.